This is again a very imperfect copy off air of a new music survey broadcast produced by Philip Norman in April of 1989.
Milliner of publicity, there is one composer who has been spending much time in the sun recently. Day trippers to Birdling's flat, south of Christchurch, may have been puzzled by the activities of a mysterious and determined-looking figure. To the casual observer, the work of John Cousins in this environment may have appeared as the leisure of an eccentric sunbather. At other times, as stones were shifted from spot to spot, it must have seemed as if a landscape gardener was practicing in the wilds. Icons for Birdling's Flat, the result of John Cousins' time at this location, was opened recently at the McDougall Art Gallery in Christchurch. On day one, an architectural student viewed the material and suggested it bore resemblances to aspects of work in his own field. My curiosity was aroused.
So was mine. The person was referring to a work which I called an azimuth projection, which consisted of a series of photographs of my shadow through a whole day from sunrise to sunset, producing sort of a curve on the landscape, which obviously was an equivalent of the curvature of the sun. And this person said that it reminded them of work that they did researching the shadows that buildings were likely to produce at various times of the day and season.
Most people since Galileo's time have taken for granted that the Earth rotates relative to the sun. Does the fact that this premise is central to your work in Icons for Birdling's Flat suggest you are questioning its validity?
I didn't undertake the work like a scientific experiment. It was more the result of sort of subjective curiosity about the fact that my experience told me that the sun was moving around the Earth. And I think everybody's experience tells them that. Science tells us it's the other way around. But the main reason that I became involved in using the sun and my shadow on the surface of the Earth was because I was interested in moving objects within their natural environment into various locations, shifting them from their natural position very slightly and subtly. And I was interested in finding a way of deciding if I was going to lift a stone up off the beach where it had been for quite a long time, or had been placed there by wave action or whatever, where was I going to put it? What kind of, how far away, or in what direction? And I found that I was actually using my shadow as a pointer, and the movement of the, I'll call it the movement of the sun, relative to my body, which allowed me to place these things in various ways, that didn't seem completely arbitrary. And that's how I became interested in watching my shadow a lot. And then that split off really into a completely different set of works, just using the shadow and the body. And that's when I became fascinated with the fact that my shadow was moving and changing, but I was standing perfectly still, and I knew from scientific theory that that the sun was also stationary, and so therefore it had to be the Earth that was moving.
As an exhibition, Icons for Birdling's Flat was comprised of five major parts. Two of these, reciprocal traverses and earth turn overlap, used the medium of video. What was captured on tape in these?
They were just segments of time encapsulated by a stationary camera. The traverses were two works. Each one used two monitors. The first one was just a documentation of the shadow of a stone moving over my face until it covered it completely. So I lay down next to a stone towards sunset and waited for the earth to turn so that the stone interpolated itself between the sun's light and me. And then I did the opposite. I allowed the shadow of my head to move across a stone so that both me and the stone had a similar experience. Environmental work is that it functions when you're actually doing it as a field trip. It's no different to a geographer or someone like that going out and performing some experiments, really, except that the motivation for the experiment, I suppose, is rather more subjective. And then one comes away from the field trip with what I call residue of the activities. The more residue you've got, the more likely it is that you're going to produce a reasonable work. But then you're faced with the problem of how do you present this material, you know. And I'm not interested in just using the material to tell a story about a particular field trip. I'm interested in trying to present the material so that it resonates with the significance that I feel the particular tasks I'm doing have. I think what I'm trying to do in the exhibition is to put forward the significance of somebody attempting to experience the turn of the earth. In other words, it's the significance of somebody trying to do that I'm interested in, rather than trying to get someone to actually have the experience themselves.
It would appear that the processes involved have become more important to you than the end results. Why is this?
I don't know why, but I think that's an absolutely valid thing to say. And it applies to all the work I'm doing. It applies to the electroacoustic work too. A letting go of the idea of contriving materials into a composition, you know, into a sort of discourse, and controlling where they go and what they're like, in a sort of a discursive argument, a musical argument. Like, that's the way one thinks of conventional musical composition. I think that's been slowly being let go, in my case, for a long time. And now, both in the environmental works and in the tape pieces, I'm interested in sounds, using sounds that have their own natural initiation and resonance and decay, and keeping and celebrating and emphasizing that naturalness, rather than using it as a raw material to feed my sort of creative machine.
Along with Icons for Bedlings Flat, many, if not all, of your installation and sculptural works use your own body or physical presence as a central image. It could be said that your art has become narcissistic, or that you have developed narcissism to an art form. Why do you continually reappear as the protagonist in your own work?
I don't know. And to be quite honest, I'm sick and tired of justifying it.
Are you at heart still a composer?
I don't know. I'm more fascinated by sonority and sound worlds than I've ever been. So to that extent, I guess I'm an addict to sonority. Whether I'm a composer or not, I think probably, if you use the definition that I tried to describe before, I don't think I am, to be quite honest. Unless one wishes to redefine what a composer is. I don't know. I feel that I'm an artist. I feel I'm a creative artist. I've always felt that. And I'm, again, the business of categorizing, I think it's fruitless. It's probably especially fruitless to ask the artist, because he or she is just not really going to know, you know. And it turns into a sort of a defensive justification.
Why have you stopped writing for traditional instruments?
Probably because I didn't have an early satisfactory education in musical literacy, even although I am a graduate from the university. I'm talking about before that. I mean, I'm obviously musically literate, but the notation problem was always a bit of a problem for me, even when I was composing conventional music. It slowed down the process that somehow or other got on the road, and I think that was simply because I wasn't familiar enough with it from an early enough age. I know it hasn't affected a lot of my contemporaries. So I think that had something to do with it, but I think it's just a personal thing. I like direct access to my materials. I like to experience them and manipulate them more directly. I mean, we would never expect a painter to write a score of his painting before he got on with painting it. And there's something about that direct involvement with the materials, like a painter has, and that you do have in an electronic music studio, or in the other works that I'm involved in, which obviously suits me. It just suits my personality, that's all.
One of your recent electroacoustic works is called Tense Text. It takes the form of many answers to a general question about the male psyche. What motivated your flood of answers?
Yeah, a very simple motivation, really. The culprit was the tape recorder. I was involved in a simple interview, a bit like this, with an art critic who was asking me about various things about my work, and I gave these answers, and then a long time later, 6 months later, she sent me a copy of the tape, which a long time after that I decided to listen to, and discovered that in fact a lot of the things that I'd responded to, a lot of the questions that she'd asked and the way I'd answered them, I didn't actually agree with any longer. I decided to reconstruct answers to the questions which I felt were closer to the truth. And then I realized that this was quite difficult to do. That the truth, actually, was an extremely complex and enormously multifaceted sort of thing. And answers to questions usually encapsulate just one little facet of it. So this produced a whole raft of answers to questions and so forth, and I constructed a series of personas by using the acoustic space, people in various places in the acoustic space, all of whom had my voice, asking each other questions about what the answer was to the question that had been asked. And in the middle of this, I introduced the original question and answer. And slowly, the thing sort of developed into a sort of a nightmare of investigation, which in the end finished up an absurdity, really.
The hesitation isn't important at all. What we need to be listening to is the interpretation. It's the interpretation that the commentator made. That's the important thing. Will you let the tape run? Just let it stop the tape. We'll have to go back and listen again.
Another recent electroacoustic work is entitled Signs in the Vicinity of Memories. What signs are used and whose memories are scarred?
Well, the signs are simple domestic scenarios. Making coffee, having a shave, having a bath, washing your hands, flushing the toilet. Recorded with a multi-microphone setup so that I could get detailed access to the actual sonorities produced by these mundane signs. So that they're always recognisable as signs, but they're played back in such a way that, what I would call the beauty, the aesthetic beauty of their envelopes and spectrums and so forth, and morphologies, are exaggerated. And every now and then there is a memory, spoken memory, using my voice, of particular things that I remember from my childhood. They're actually from adolescence. They refer to initial sexual experiences. They're sort of around the area of, burgeoning maleness in an early 1950s New Zealand society. And those two things are put together and left separate. And that's why I say that the memories are in the vicinity of the signs, but they're not actually manipulated or contrived any further. They're just sort of put together, and one makes of the combination whatever one likes.